For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we'll be delving into some fascinating real-life stories. Holly Kite introduces us to the Roaring Girls.
So she was the epitome of a Roaring Girl. She was an anti-woman. She stood for everything that women weren't supposed to be.
Ursula and Alistair Buchan describe the recording of Beyond the 39 Steps.
When you read it, you don't realise just how emotional it would be.
People have told me that they cried.
Jeremy Paxman reveals a family tie to World War I.
The story of what this extraordinary conflict did to our country. I think that it changed more or less everything.
And bringing us right up to date, blogger Holly Tuke reviews It's Not What It Looks Like by YouTube sensation Molly Burke. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Each month, the publisher HarperCollins donates audiobook copies of all its new titles to the RNIB library, ensuring that blind and partially sighted readers have access to new works of fiction and non-fiction as soon as our sighted peers do. Among this month's titles is Roaring Girls, The Forgotten Feminists of British History. It tells the story of eight remarkable women. The book's author, Holly Kite, joined me in the studio. So let's define our terms first. Mm. What exactly is a roaring girl?
Well, so the dictionary definition is a loud, bawdy, boisterous woman, especially one who takes on a masculine role. But the actual phrase comes from a play that was written in 1611 by Thomas Middleton and Thomas Dekker, who were prolific playwrights in the Jacobean period. They were contemporaries of Shakespeare. And they wrote a play called The Roaring Girl. And it was based on a character called Moll Cutpurse, who was a foul-mouthed, pipe-smoking, cross-dressing thief. So she was the epitome of a roaring girl. She was an anti-woman. She stood for everything that women weren't supposed to be at that time. They were supposed to be meek and modest and submissive and obedient and silent. And Moll Cutpurse was not that. And she was based on a real woman called Mary Frith, who is the first woman in my book.
And she's a fabulous character. I'm not sure I would have wanted to have lived next door to her.
No, you'd have to watch your wallet if you lived next door to her.
Not only was she a thief, but she organised a whole band of thieves.
Yes.
And somehow managed to get a licence to be able to sell stolen goods back to their owners.
Yes, she was a kind of Fagin-type character, where she just sort of ended up running a coterie of thieves who just pickpocketed for her. And I think she just had a knack of getting away with it. And she obviously realised that this was a safer way of doing it, to just get other people to do your dirty work for you. And yeah, she just built up a kind of empire and managed to set up what she called a lost property office, whereby people who had had their purses stolen would come to her to get them back again, and she'd been the one who'd organised the theft in the first place. So she had quite a good thing going.
And she achieved quite some notoriety, as you say. The
yes.
play was written about her, mm-hmm. and she even appeared on stage after one performance, which makes her the first woman documented to have appeared on stage in British theatre.
Yes, so this is before women were allowed on the stage, when female parts were still played by young boys in all of the plays that were put on. But because this play was about her, I assume that she was in some way in cahoots with the playwrights and was able to appear at the end as herself and did a little song, played a little bit of lute, and was in full male dress, and she got in a heck of a lot of trouble for it because it wasn't allowed. So she ended up in prison.
But she lived to fight another day, and actually she wrote her own autobiography, maybe.
Or did she? Yeah, so there's a diary, in inverted commas, The Life and Death of Mrs. Mary Frith, which was supposedly written by her, but it was published 3 years after she died, and she was very probably illiterate, so it seems highly unlikely that she wrote it herself. I think it's much more likely that people were capitalising on the trend for faux biographies of criminals, which were very popular at the time, and her general notoriety, and a couple of hack writers just decided to write it. But there's a lot of stuff in there that I think comes from true stories that were either floating around the city because she was so notorious that people talked about her a lot. They may have known her, they may have got stories directly from her, we're not sure, but it's quite a lurid tale of her misdeeds.
But she managed to redefine the role of what women could do. Back in the 17th century, they could either get married and have children,
yes,
or be spinsters or old maids. There was no middle ground.
No, exactly. And she put forward the idea that she never married. In the play, it's absolutely categoric that she never married. In fact, she did marry, but it seems like she possibly married with an ulterior motive to basically be able to start her own business, because women at this time were legal non-entities. If they were married, they weren't able to own their own property, keep their own money, sign contracts, all of these things. So Mary Frith did a sort of clever thing whereby she put herself out there as a single woman who could run her own business, her lost property office, but she sneakily got married in order to avoid the law, because women women who were married, because they were legal non-entities, their misdeeds were put down to their husbands, because everything that a woman did was obviously her husband's responsibility. So she could always avoid any legal ramifications by being a married woman when she chose to be.
And the flip side of that is, of course, that women have no rights pretty much up until the beginning of the 20th century. And all eight of your characters are women who are trying to be themselves in a world that expects them to be meek and mild and submissive and hand over all responsibility for decision-making to men.
Yeah, this was a very deliberate decision on my part. I specifically wanted all of the women in the book to live before feminism and before women's rights started to kick in. So before the mid to late 19th century, when the women's rights movement started to take off. What fascinated me was the idea of how women negotiated the world before they had any kind of rights and before there was a feminist movement to kind of get behind, when they were living with such strict moral codes and social conventions, with no legal rights whatsoever. How did women who didn't fit the mould, how on earth did they negotiate that world? If you liked dressing in men's clothes, if you liked swearing, and if you had a burning ambition and you were fiercely intelligent and you wanted a career and you wanted to write and all of these things, how on earth did you do that? How did they find the loopholes to make that happen for themselves?
We'll come back to cross-dressing in a minute, but in the introduction you point out that you can't judge these women by modern feminist standards. They're proto-feminists.
Yes.
They don't have the ability to fight for their rights.
No, it's too anachronistic to expect them to have the same set of values that we have as feminists today. With every wave of feminism, our expectations have got higher and higher and higher. And these women couldn't afford to have the expectations that we have today. Their expectations were so much lower. All they wanted was the chance to get an education, to be able to work, to be able to wear what they wanted to wear, to be able to write a book. You know, really like basic stuff that today we completely take for granted as being our absolute right. So they were working within a completely different set of parameters. And it was much harder. All the odds were stacked against them. That's why I found it incredible that they did what they did, because there was so much standing in their way.
Now, cross-dressing was one way for women to be able to have some of the rights of men. It was very risky, but it wasn't very uncommon.
No, this is one of the things I discovered when I was researching the book that just completely thrilled me, that there was a Europe-wide trend that started in the 1570s and carried on with various peaks and troughs until the early 19th century. And I was just flabbergasted. I just thought, how amazing. These women just... I mean, a lot of them got in trouble for it. I think there were various reasons why they did it. Some of them were trying to evade the law occasionally, like one of the women in my book, Charlotte Chalk, had to avoid the debtors on occasion. Some of them undoubtedly will have done it for sexual reasons, because they were lesbians or whichever. They were never particularly honest about why they were doing it.
Anne Lister, who was the subject of a TV production last year, yes. Gentleman Jack, she did it for those reasons, didn't she?
Yes, exactly. It was just an expression of their personality, and it was also a way of saying, I want to do more than the average woman is allowed to do. It was about expressing a different side of your personality. And then for some women who actually lived as men, it was about having an adventure. It was about opening the door to adventure or work. So Charlotte Chalk, she was an actress by trade, but when she fell on hard times, she managed to get all sorts of jobs as a man that she couldn't get as a woman. So it was sometimes just a practicality, or it was for Hannah Snell, who was a soldier who went off to war. It was to have an adventure and to do something exciting, things that weren't available to women in their normal clothes.
Now, you've mentioned my favourite character, but I think Charlotte Chalk is terrific. She was an actress, a playwright, she ran her own theatre, she lived as Charles Brown, and she was the daughter of probably the most famous actor of the 18th century, Colley Cibber, who disowned her. She was the first celebrity reality show, wasn't she?
Yes. She was a complete enfant terrible. She was outrageous, and her family couldn't handle it at all. She knew from a very young age she was going to be an actress. She started cross-dressing at the age of 4. She tells a really funny anecdote about dressing up in her father's clothes and marching around in the garden, pretending to be the little squire, and her father screaming at her to stop. And this just went through her entire life. She was just an incorrigible actress. So she eventually made it onto the stage, made a name for herself, and particularly specialised in cross-dressing roles. She particularly loved dressing in men's clothes, and it was a kind of inevitable progression that one day she walked off stage and just stayed in costume and just walked off and was like, no, I'm going to be Charles Brown now. I'm going to see how that works out. And yeah, her father was a celebrity. He was also famously quite a louche character, and despite his own dissolute life, couldn't stand it in his daughter and completely disowned her and cut her out of most of his will. He gave her £5 when he died and wouldn't speak to her.
And it's those double standards rearing their heads again. Anyway, do you have a favourite?
Oh, it's so difficult. So I think while I was writing them, I think each of them was my favourite because they each just enthralled me and I fell in love with all of them. If I had to choose one of them, I think I would go with Caroline Norton, who is the last woman in the book. She was an extraordinary woman. She was also related to a famous man. She was the granddaughter of the famous comic playwright Sheridan, and she was beautiful. Her and her two sisters were absolute society beauties. She was incredibly witty and charming. She was just a fabulous woman. But she was married off to an absolute rotter who abused her, so she was a survivor of domestic violence. And when their marriage broke down, he not only exposed her to a very public scandal by accusing her of adultery with the Prime Minister, Lord Melbourne, which she may or may not have been guilty of. But when their marriage broke down, he refused to let her see her children because, as a legal non-entity, as she was, she had absolutely no right to custody of her children. She had no right even to see her children. And he made sure, during the negotiations of their separation, that she wasn't allowed to see them. For years, this went on. And instead of accepting this, Caroline Norton went on the offensive and started campaigning fiercely for women's rights, to revolutionise women's custody rights and their marital rights. She was an incredible woman.
And we have the first custody law to thank her for, don't we?
We do. 1839, I think it was, the Custody of Infants Act was her doing. And it was the first ever piece of feminist legislation to enter the statute books.
Now, she, like quite a few of the other characters in the book, found escape through writing, didn't she? And
yes.
That really comes through. I mean, Margaret Cavendish, who was writing in the 17th century,
yes,
found that was her freedom from misogyny. Were you struck by how many of them had either taken pen to paper or told their stories to others?
Yes, it's useful that they did, because that's the prime reason why their stories have come down to us, is because they wrote so much. And especially in an era when most women were illiterate, it's incredibly important for them to have had a voice at this time, because most women did not. And it was usually a way for them to express the oppression that they were feeling. So Margaret Cavendish, for example, wrote some of the earliest sort of proto-feminist fiction that we have. Some of her heroines, cross-dressing, gender-fluid, gun-toting women, they're incredible. And this is in the 1650s.
It's science fiction in parts, isn't it?
Yes, so she wrote The Blazing World, which is this incredible sort of fantasy utopia thing where her heroine is sort of washed up in this strange land where they've got sort of orange hair and purple skin, and she sort of sets up her own empire. She kind of educates them and sets up her own religion, and it's going to be a place of equality where women are respected. So she kind of lives out her fantasy of the world she wants to live in, where women are allowed to be educated and are allowed into public office and are allowed the power that she can't have in her life.
Well, we're incredibly fortunate that Roaring Girls has made it into the R&IB Talking Books Library. It's a super audiobook. Helen Keeley just
took to it, didn't she?
Yes.
Did you choose her as a narrator?
I didn't get to choose, but she was sent to me for sort of approval, and I was immediately just like, yep, she's great. She's an absolute pro. She knows exactly what she's doing. And I've had really good feedback from friends who have listened to the audiobook who said it's so engaged and lively and fabulous, and I'm delighted with it.
And do you have any plans for a sequel?
I would love to do a sequel because I had a big old long list of women that I wanted to write about. And when I first had the idea, I was going to do sort of 25 women. And then as soon as I started writing, I was like, that's going to be quite difficult. So I had to whittle it down, really whittle it down to 8. So I would love to do a volume 2 because there are so many more women out there that I would love to write about.
Well, Holly Kite, thank you so much. Roaring Girls is a terrific read. And as I say, it's in the RNIB library. And I hope you'll come back when you've published the sequel.
When Mary Frith completed her act of penance at St. Paul's Cross in 1612, her name, or at least that of her alter ego, Moll Cutpurse, had been on the lips of most Jacobean Londoners for several years, especially those who frequented the playhouses, taverns, brothels and bear pits of Bankside, the lawless entertainment district of Southwark that lay conveniently outside the city's jurisdiction. Whether they loved or loathed her, feared or admired her, Mary's notorious career as a cross-dressing thief, or cutpurse, and street entertainer had fascinated the public, and by the time she'd reached her mid-twenties, she had achieved cult celebrity status, so much so that several playwrights had already appropriated, refashioned, and immortalised her persona as a wholly unconventional folk heroine.
Helen Keeley narrating Roaring Girls by Holly Kite, which is TB 704857. And Holly will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Jeremy Paxman takes a personal view of the First World War. And RNIB See Differently Award winner Holly Tuke reviews an uplifting memoir. But first, John Buchan is known throughout the world as the author of The 39 Steps. Since its publication in 1915, this seminal thriller has never been out of print, inspiring generations of writers and scores of adaptations, not least Alfred Hitchcock's classic film. Last year, I interviewed Buchan's granddaughter, Ursula, after the publication of her biography, Beyond the 39 Steps. At the time, we discussed the possibility of an audiobook version, and I'm delighted to report that it's just been released. So I invited Ursula and her narrator to join me at the Talking Book Studios. It's a fantastic audiobook version. Did you enjoy recording the introduction yourself?
Well, I did. I have to say, I didn't want to do the whole thing. And in fact, Bloomsbury asked me who I would like. I thought, well, I slur my words from time to time. I'm not going to make a very good job of this, but I would like to do the introduction and the afterword because those are the two personal bits. But in a classic case of nepotism, I offered the services of my nephew Alistair because he's professionally trained as an actor and has a very nice voice and also is interested in his great-grandfather.
Alistair, as listeners could probably hear you chuckling in the background, you are an actor and voiceover actor and presumably were delighted to be asked to narrate your first audiobook.
Yes, it came out of nowhere, actually, because I'd read the book. I don't suppose I'd thought about an audiobook necessarily.
Why should you?
And yes, no, I was absolutely thrilled.
What was the most surprising thing that you learnt about your great-grandfather as you were reading the book?
I don't think I realised quite how unwell he was throughout his life. He really did struggle an awful lot.
Yes, I didn't realise that either.
Yeah.
Because he hid it so well.
Yeah.
The duodenal ulcer that he had for most of his adult life, which in those days was not curable, would have stopped many careers in their tracks, really.
Incapacitated a lesser man.
I was struck by his good humour throughout his life. As you say, he was clearly in a lot of pain, and yet he seems to have been fantastic company. Everybody liked him, whether it was the population of Canada, where he was Governor General, or politicians like Roosevelt or Stanley Baldwin, or actors like Douglas Fairbanks Jr. He was a
remarkably popular and affable man.
He certainly was. He was delightful company, a sparkling conversationist, and he seemed to be able to just connect with so many different kinds of people. Did you find that, Alistair, when you were reading it? You know, it's extraordinary.
Yes.
The people he got to know. And
entirely unexpected people as well, for sort of the work that he did and the circles that you'd expect him to move in.
Like Jimmy Maxton, who was a communist and was put in prison during the First World War for fomenting trouble in the shipyards. They'd been at the same school, not at the same time, and they remained firm friends.
Highborn or lowborn, he was adored.
Yes, he was.
Well, I suppose he was rather a model for social mobility. He wasn't exactly working class, but he was not of the privileged class through birth, and yet through education and the exercise of his brain and a good marriage, he rose to the very top of the establishment.
I think that's true. Not necessarily working class, but certainly not upper class at all.
Well, no, and no money. I mean, I think sons of the manse or children of the manse in Scotland tended to have a cultured upbringing, but there certainly was never a spare penny. Education was very good in Scotland at the end of the 19th century. And I think a lot of Scots rose to be important people in many different areas across the world. I mean, he was a remarkably successful undergraduate because he worked so hard and he earned a lot of money, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And that certainly comes out in the book, is just how hard he worked throughout his life, actually. Possibly, I think, at times detrimental to his health, but certainly in those university days.
And I was astounded to find out just how prolific he was as an author. I, like many people, knew all about the Richard Hannay novels, The 39 Steps and Greenmantle, but I hadn't realised he produced a very authoritative and multi-volume history of the First World War.
While it was going on.
Mm.
And at times, while he was director of information, as they called it, propaganda, he was remarkably prolific. And also nearly 1,000 articles in newspapers and magazines as well, over a long period. So he was a journalist as well as an author. And then, of course, all those other things he did as well. You know, barrister, publisher, MP.
Yes.
Governor General.
Yes, he didn't really rest on his laurels at all, did he?
No, no. We still do have this old Protestant work ethic.
Work ethic, yes.
I won't say me particularly, but it's quite
noticeable. No, I was nervous of saying me as well, but I think I notice it in other people.
Yeah, yeah. Quite.
Since, Alistair, this is the first audiobook that you have recorded, do you hope that it's going to open the way for you to narrate more? Did you enjoy the experience?
It's a much harder experience, and I've spoke to a number of friends before I did it who do quite a lot of audiobooks, and they all warned me that it would be more difficult than I was expecting it to be. I would love to do more. I have quite a distinctive voice, so I think I have to wait for the right project to come along. But I would love to do more. It's a very, very interesting thing to do. It drives you a little bit mad, because I'd read the book, but when you read it, you don't realise just how emotional it would be.
People have told me that they cried at times.
They cried when Alistair died, and they cried when John Buchan died, and
that it does have an emotional...
It does have a real emotional impact.
But I felt sorry for Alistair, because I do go in for rather long sentences sometimes.
Absolutely outstanding training, though. In terms of breath control to get to the end.
Yes.
Well, I suppose also you know Ursula's voice. You can have that voice in your head whilst you're reading the book.
Yes, that's true, because I suppose from that point of view I had an advantage, because you can guess at the tone with which you're saying things. Because it's not...
You know my sense of humour, for a start.
I know your sense of humour, and I know that... Because it's not just casual, just accounts of everything that happened. Like, your personality comes through it and your opinions on certain aspects of his life. So I was keyed into that.
I don't think I had any idea quite what a remarkable man he was. Everybody told me he was a great man, but I didn't really sort of see it until I actually had to do the research. And I hope that comes through.
Well, that struck me, was the sort of... Just what a Renaissance man he was, and how much he did in such a relatively short period of time.
And that comes from that upbringing. You couldn't just sit in an ivory tower writing books all your lives. For him, that would have been self-indulgent. He had to go out into the public square and do something that he thought was really useful.
Who were his big influences?
I think it's Robert Burns.
Walter Scott.
It's Walter Scott, hugely, yeah. Isn't it? And actually, for style, it's interesting people like T.H. Huxley, the scientist, and Newman, Cardinal Newman, too.
Oh, really?
He looked to them for style. And the great thing about him is that he believed in clarity. There's hardly a obfuscatory sentence in the whole canon, really. And that requires courage, too, because if you're not really certain of what you're going to say, then you sort of hedge it around. He didn't do that
all the time nowadays. I mean, that sort of political discourse is 300 words when two will do.
Exactly.
And he cuts all of the fat off that. Yeah,
quite. Right.
Well, I'm rather hoping that you will re-record the Hannay novels, which haven't been recorded recently, and I think could do with an update for the 21st century.
I'm absolutely 100% behind that idea. Yes, actually, they haven't been done. There was a
Did Robert Powell do some of them some years ago?
I think so.
He did a couple of years ago, and I think there possibly was a Radio 4 adaptation about 9 or 10 years ago as well. And there are some really very, very bad versions on YouTube.
Robert Powell was a very, very good Hannay, actually, both in the... he did the third 39 Steps.
The ITV film, wasn't it?
It was a film. Yes, it wasn't television, it was a film.
It came
out in 78, I think. He was Richard Hannay. But he also did some television Hannay stories as well.
Oh, did he
well.
Do something?
Yes. So he's excellent. But there's always an opportunity for updating. I think the historical novels would be terrific, actually, as audiobooks.
Actually, they would,
Blanket
they?
Of the Dark, Midwinter, Witchwood, all these would be absolutely marvellous as audiobooks. I don't know if they have been done. I don't think so.
I don't think any of them have.
We certainly in the R&IB Talking Books Library have versions of a lot of books that aren't commercially available. But again, a lot of them were recorded in the 50s, 60s. I'd rather like to hear the short stories, which I know are great favourites of yours, Ursula, aren't they?
Very much so. Even the very early ones, I think, are exciting and tense, and you get all the John Buchan preoccupations about landscape and weather being protagonists in the action. No, I mean, they're terrific. I'd love to hear those in an audiobook.
Well, let's hope that we do go beyond the 39 steps with this audiobook and that it will lead a publisher to re-record versions of some of the lesser-known works. Alistair Buchan, Ursula Buchan, thank you so much for coming into the R&IB Talking Book Studios and talking to us on the show.
Well, thank you very much indeed.
Much. Yeah.
The audiobook version of Beyond the 39 Steps, A Life of John Buchan, is out now wherever you buy your books, and fingers crossed, a copy should be on its way to the R&IB library. In the meantime, a wide selection of John Buchan's novels and short stories is available from the R&IB library in a full range of accessible formats. For more information, visit the website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on R&IB Connect Radio. Still to come in this week's show, Holly Tuke finds honesty, hope and humour in a memoir about living with sight loss, and Holly Kite shares the books of her life. But before that, as we've heard, John Buchan not only set several novels during the First World War, he also wrote a contemporary history of it. The conflict is also the subject of a book by Jeremy Paxman. He discussed it with Robert Kirkwood.
The family never learned precisely what killed Uncle Charlie. Was he machine-gunned to death? Was he one of the thousands who'd been weakened by the dysentery and typhoid that quickly spread among the men, pinned down in disgusting conditions in the gullies below the enemy machine guns for days on end? The memory of some others who died there, bakers' sons from the Orkneys, gardeners and footmen from the royal estate at Sandringham, the almost 500 men of the Dublin Fusiliers, or the son of the Vicar of Deal who won the Victoria Cross for repeatedly wading ashore under fire to rescue wounded men from the beaches, has been kept more conscientiously alive. The deaths of over 11,000 Australian and New Zealand soldiers at Gallipoli are venerated as a sacred part of their nation's histories.
A clip of Jeremy Paxman reading the introduction to Great Britain's Great War, with the rest of the text being read by Roy McMillan. Jeremy Paxman told me why he decided to write the book.
Well, what had interested me for quite a long time is not so much the stories of the battles, I'm not a military historian, but the story of what this extraordinary conflict did to our country. I think that it changed more or less everything. I think if you were a Victorian time traveller and had come back in 1914, you would understand exactly how the country worked. But if you came back 10 years later, in 1924, after the war, you wouldn't have a clue.
Now, what actually came first? Was it the book or the TV show?
I wrote the synopsis for the book, and then I gave that to the television producers and to the publishers. And I sort of worked on the two simultaneously, really. I suppose the book came a bit first, except for some bits towards the end, when frankly, I fell rather behind.
Because I noticed the book's a lot more personal to you than the TV show was.
Is it?
Well, on a TV show, we didn't hear about your family, but that's how the actual book starts.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't think there's any... This is my great-uncle Charlie, you mean? Who signed up in that rush of volunteers in the autumn of 1914. Possibly the spring of 1915. I think it was 1914. He was dead by August 1915. He was a private in the Royal Army Medical Corps. I don't suggest that there's anything unusual about that experience. I think every family had very often something very, very similar. I mean, there was something like 16,000 villages in England and Wales in 1918, and there were 40 of them to which all the men who had volunteered or been conscripted to serve returned at the end of the war. So this was a massive, massive casualty level. And I don't suggest there's anything unusual about the experience of my great-uncle Charlie beyond the fact that his photograph had hung on the wall when I was growing up. And I'm fascinated by the fact that this is an event which has passed now from family history, really, to the realms of pure history. And, frankly, a history that's very poorly understood.
I think my family was lucky because there's a tradition of shipbuilding in the family, which was a huge essential trade at the time.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, shipbuilding, various foundries, the munitions factories, the mines, all of these had groups of men who were exempt from military service, although when things got really tough in the spring of 1918, very large numbers of these men who were in what were called reserved occupations said, I know I'm exempt from military service, but I want to serve. There were lots of people who tried it on, of course, lots of people who thought, for example, there were tripe dressers in the northwest of England who appeared saying it's an essential trade. Women can't do this. I must therefore be exempt from military service. There was even a bloke in Leeds who tried to claim that he shouldn't do his military service now and until he completed his course of hair restoration.
Now, going back to the start of the war, and it's something that's been debated on TV at the moment, but was it a necessary war?
Well, I don't know. All wars are, in a sense, unnecessary, aren't they? Because they are they're the resolving of disputes by means other than the sensible way of resolving disputes, which is to argue things out and come to an agreement. So was it necessary? I think it was inevitable. I think that at some point, I know there are people now saying that it was a war we didn't need to get into, but I think at some point there would necessarily have come a conflict with Germany and probably the rest of Europe, as was to happen again with the Second World War. There was something about German militarism, German ambitions, German imperial dreams, I think. They felt hard done by comparison with Britain and France. I think sooner or later there was bound to be a conflict, yes.
What surprised me was the fact that there were protests for peace before war broke out, very much like the protests we had before the Iraq War.
Yes, there were. Bertrand Russell, for example, who was a prominent pacifist at the time, Bertrand Russell felt that he had suddenly lost contact with his country when he saw, in those early days in August 1914, he saw people running around, apparently enthusiastic about war. I slightly dispute that. I'm not sure they were enthusiastic about war so much as enthusiastic about something that was completely unknown to them. Nobody, of course, appreciated what the cost would be. And Bertrand Russell wandering around London was just astonished and appalled by what he saw, and felt that he just didn't understand Britain any longer.
Hmm.
But there were pacifists right from the start, yes.
You discussed the pacifists and also the conscientious objectors in the TV show. Now, why did you call them cranks?
I didn't call the conscientious objectors cranks. I said it has always seemed to me that the extreme conscientious objectors were cranks. That's not saying that all conscientious objectors were cranks. I'm saying, or what I said when I was asked by the producer, what do you really think of these people? And I said, well, I rather admire those who refuse to join in something because everyone else was doing it. I admire them for that. But the extreme ones who refused to have anything to do with the war strike me as being so eccentric that the word crank is merited. There were, for example, many Quakers who went and served in something called the Friends Ambulance Unit and were largely admired by soldiers because although they didn't fight, they were extremely brave in rescuing casualties and treating them. So, you know, and there were many other conscientious objectors who did vital war work, whether it was working in factories or working on the land. So, you know, there were many other ways of coming to the aid of a country in a situation, of course, it shouldn't have been in, perhaps.
Mm.
But just to refuse to do anything does strike me as an eccentric position.
Now, you looked at the movie The Battle of the Somme and talk about how it was a gamble that paid off, showing the public real images of the horror of war, galvanising the public behind the war effort. Now, why do you think subsequent images of war, say from the war in Vietnam, had the opposite effect?
I think there are a number of differences, of course. You're talking about images of the Vietnam War which helped consolidate a lot of anti-war opinion. Now, there was an anti-war opinion before much of that was seen. It was not a popular war, even from the start. It was very easily got into, the Vietnam War, and was very difficult to get out of. But people were experiencing those images of the war in their own homes, of course. They were seeing them via television. Whereas cinema was a collective experience. This was silent cinema, of course, watched in picture houses. Vast numbers of people, huge numbers of people, for the first 3 or 4 weeks of the screening of this film. People had never seen anything like this before, and they experienced it collectively. And I think perhaps that's part of the explanation. I don't know, but I would guess that maybe has something to do with it.
And there was also a fear of invasion, and for the first time, almost civilians were also in danger during war.
Oh, indeed. I mean, the first trenches weren't dug in France or in Flanders. The first trenches were dug in southern England for fear of invasion. And there were civilian casualties right from the early days of the war, whether they were from shells fired from German naval ships, as happened up on the northeast coast, Scarborough, Whitby, Hartlepool, both Hartlepools, in December 1914. Subsequently, Zeppelins, big airships flying over the east coast cities, dropping bombs. And then, of course, by 1917, you get full-scale bombing raids, large numbers of German bombers coming over and dropping death out of the sky. So there were civilian casualties right throughout the war, of course, on a much smaller scale than in the army. But there were civilian casualties right from the start. And I think that it was understood very early on that it was a war that would involve everybody.
Mm. Now, you mentioned casualties, but some of the casualties from the front line, be it by mustard gas or be it by shell fragments or bullets, but there was an awful lot of sight loss and blindness caused by the war.
There was a tremendous amount of loss of eyes or damage to the eyes during the First World War. All sorts of areas of medicine made huge advances during this war. Of course, it would have been better had there not been a war. I'm not saying that. But there were, of necessity, huge strides made in medicine during the First World War. Take another example, not blindness, but amputation. If you look at the number of men who returned without legs or arms after the First World War, you will find the proportion goes down as the war goes on. The reason for that is that in the early stages of the war, it wasn't realised how much damage could be done by the contamination of the filth of the trenches. Once that was realised and new forms of antiseptic were developed and the need for what was called wound excision, which was to cut away any flesh that might be slightly contaminated, so you stopped gangrene setting in, then the number of amputations fell. Similar advances happened in plastic surgery and the reconstruction of faces, and there were many advances, I'm not familiar with the details, in the care of the eyes, the care and treatment of the eyes, but very large numbers of men were blinded. And one of the most moving images, of course, of the war is those poor blinded men after a gas attack, each man in single file with his hand on the shoulder of the man in front because they couldn't see where they were going. Mm. And, you know, these are the early days when you see at St. Dunstan's, which is still commemorated now on Armistice Sunday in November, you still see these old veterans from there. Not First World War veterans, obviously, but you still see that there is a great ongoing duty of care to men who have had their eyesight damaged or destroyed in war.
St. Dunstan's, of course, still provide that support, but under the new name of Blind Veterans UK. Now, that image you mentioned of the soldier standing in single file is on the wall of the RNIB Talking Book Studios for the simple reason that those soldiers returning from the front with no sight and perhaps losing some sensitivity in their fingertips, so Braille was really hard to learn, that's where the Talking Book service started.
I didn't know that.
Mm. That's
thank you for telling
that
me.
That was the impetus of the Talking Book
I don't know about
service.
You, but I think that the whole point of life, what a ridiculous thing to say, but it's certainly what's always got me out of bed in the morning is curiosity, and I now feel I've learned something today, which is a lot better than it's been so far today.
Uncle Charlie must have made it clear when he signed up that his mother, Florina, was a widow, for the printed Sir with which the form begins has been scored out and replaced with a handwritten Madam. The impersonal tone resumes with the printed sentence, "It is my painful duty to inform you that a report has this day been received from the War Office notifying the death of..." And here the Colonel in charge of Medical Corps Administration at Aldershot has inserted into the blank spaces Uncle Charlie's name, rank and number, adding, "Number 34 Field Ambulance of the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force," in the space left blank for his unit. The cause of death was, and here an entire line of the form is left empty, which the Colonel has made no attempt to fill, just writing the single unilluminating word, "Wounds."
A clip from Jeremy Paxman's Great Britain's Great War, which of course is available from RNIB Talking Books. And Jeremy, thank you so much for joining me today on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Robert. Great Britain's Great War by Jeremy Paxman is TB21372. Now, before we hear the books of Holly Kite's life, here at Read On, we love to hear about the books that you're reading, whether they're new titles or old favourites. You can email us via the new address, radio@rnib.org.uk. That's radio@rnib.org.uk. Holly Tuke did just that. The winner of Social Influencer of the Year at the RNIB See Differently Awards, Holly is also an avid audiobook fan.
Hi, I'm Holly Tuke. I'm a disability blogger and writer. Here's my review of It's Not What It Looks Like by Molly Burke, which is read by Molly herself.
Gypsy was so beautiful. We used to get stopped everywhere we'd go, just so people could tell us how beautiful she was. I used to joke with kids that she had walked in paint, because her forepaws were perfectly white, and her tail had a white tip, just like a paintbrush. She had a white milk spill right across her chest, a white racing stripe between her eyes, and a pastel pink birthmark on her white snout just above her nose. If you drew a cartoon of a dog, it would look like Gypsy. She was so perfectly spotted, it looked like she had been drawn.
I recently read It's Not What It Looks Like by Molly Burke, and it is an Audible original, so it is only available on Audible. Molly is a blind motivational speaker and YouTuber from Canada. She is best known for her videos on visual impairment and disability. She has collaborated with some of the world's most famous YouTubers and has millions of subscribers. It's Not What It Looks Like is an autobiography about Molly's life as a person with a visual impairment. I was really intrigued by the book, as I'm blind myself. I'd heard really good things about it, so I was keen to see what it was all about.
Talk about highlight and contour. Hers were on point. She was hot and she knew it. Gypsy and I were so alike in what we enjoyed doing, with just a couple of exceptions. She didn't like shopping, probably because it wasn't enough about her. And she was big on catching bugs. If a bug were flying anywhere nearby, she would jump up, catch it, and eat it. Flies, bees, wasps, it didn't matter. I don't know how she managed it, but she never got stung. And trust me, if she had gotten stung, she would have made sure I knew about it. That girl was the first to yelp if anything was even remotely uncomfortable. And she never passed up an opportunity for attention.
Molly was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, RP, at the age of 5, and lost her sight completely when she was a teenager. The book follows her journey from childhood to being a teenager and gives a glimpse into her life today. She shares her experiences of education, both mainstream and specialist school, finding independence, learning to use the long cane, getting her first guide dog, motivational speaking, and everything about her life and blindness. As well as sharing her experiences, she tackles some of the stigmas and misconceptions surrounding blindness, so it is a great read for sighted people who are wanting to learn more about sight loss and also to possibly change their perceptions on visual impairment. Molly opens up about her struggles with bullying and anxiety. I feel like sight loss and mental health is something that isn't really discussed. The media doesn't really talk about it, so a huge well done to Molly for sharing her experiences and shining a light on this. I feel like it is something that many people can relate to, and it may be a comfort to those who are experiencing similar things that Molly did. She shares the perks and struggles of being blind, which is something that many blind and visually impaired people could relate to. I was nodding along to many aspects, and I could most definitely relate. She shares the ups and downs from education to her guide dog experience, her mental health, and starting her career. She gives an insight into how she built her successful business and what it is today, becoming a motivational speaker, and also gives a fascinating insight into travelling the world with your guide dog when you have no useful vision.
Gypsy was my rock. She was with me through everything. The vision loss, bullying, and school transfers. My first boyfriend and my first breakup. She was even my date to prom. I had to turn down the guy who asked me to prom because Gypsy had asked me first. That night, her entire harness was covered in flowers to match my wrist corsage. And she proceeded to spend the entire night eating all of those flowers. When it was time to dance, I'd tap my shoulders and she'd jump up to put her paws around my neck. Then I'd put my arms behind her back and we'd slow dance.
In terms of the narration, Molly narrates the book herself. I always love books that are narrated by the authors, and I feel like if someone else had have narrated this book, then it just wouldn't have been the same. The fact that Molly narrates it gives an extra touch. I thoroughly enjoyed reading the book and I would recommend it to anyone. It is real, honest, and gives a true account of what it's like to live with a visual impairment in a predominantly sighted world. It shows that there are barriers when living with sight loss, but how you can overcome these and live a fulfilling and independent life. A huge well done to Molly Burke for sharing her experiences, tackling the stigmas, but also educating others and helping others through her writing and her work.
She was with me when I graduated from high school, when I moved into my first apartment in Toronto, and while I traveled the world speaking to audiences. Guide dogs typically work for 6 to 8 years, and the Mira Foundation does annual checkups on their dogs to make sure they're fit to keep working. After Gypsy and I had been together for 7 years, I was pretty sure she'd still be working for me for at least another year. I knew her guiding was still safe. Sure enough, at her annual checkup, she was approved for another year.
It's Not What It Looks Like, written and read by Molly Burke, is available on Audible.
Thanks, Holly. You can find Holly's blog at lifeofablindgirl.com. And we hope to hear more from Holly in future shows. Now it's back to Holly Kite to share the books of her life. Holly, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
So this was very difficult to choose because I treasure every single book I read as a child. I've kept almost all of them. But I decided in the end to go for The Wolves of Willoughby Chase by Joan Aiken, which I read as a child, and I absolutely loved it. It's set in an alternate history when James III is on the throne and savage wolves are roaming around the North Country. And there are two little girls, Bonnie and Sylvia, who are left in a big old country house. Their parents have gone away and they are left to the mercy of an evil governess called Miss Slycarp, who's trying to do them out of their inheritance. And it's just a great adventure story. But I think it's also quite heavily informed the stuff I love reading as an adult, because I love sort of 19th century gothic. I love ghost stories. I love all that kind of dark stuff. And I think that comes from that. It's a wonderful, wonderful book.
It was dusk, winter dusk. Snow lay white and shining over the pleated hills, and icicles hung from the forest trees. Snow lay piled on the dark road across Willoughby Wold, but from dawn men had been clearing it with brooms and shovels. There were hundreds of them at work, wrapped in sacking because of the bitter cold, and keeping together in groups for fear of the wolves, grown savage and reckless from hunger. Snow lay thick, too, upon the roof of Willoughby Chase, the great house that stood on an open eminence in the heart of the wold. But for all that, the chase looked an inviting home, a warm and welcoming stronghold. Its rosy herringbone brick was bright and well cared for. Its numerous turrets and battlements stood up sharp against the sky, and the crenellated balconies, corniced with snow, each held a golden square of window. The house was all alight within, and the joyous hubbub of its activity contrasted with the sombre sighing of the wind and the hideous howling of the wolves without. In the nursery, a little girl was impatiently dancing up and down before the great window, 14 feet high, which faced out over the park and commanded the long black expanse of road. "Will she be here soon, Patton? Will she?" was her continual cry. "We shall hear soon enough, I dare say, Miss Bonnie," was the inevitable reply from her maid, who, on hands and knees in front of the fire, was folding and goffering the frills of 20 lace petticoats.
Charlotte Streven's narrating The Wolves of Willoughby Chase by Joan Aiken, which is TB7635. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I'm going to cheat a little bit with this and mention two, because there's one that I do absolutely love, which is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke, which is just, I think, a word-perfect masterpiece.
Some years ago, there was in the city of York a society of magicians. They met upon the third Wednesday of every month and read each other long, dull papers upon the history of English magic. They were gentlemen magicians, which is to say they had never harmed anyone by magic, nor ever done anyone the slightest good. In fact, to own the truth, not one of these magicians had ever cast the smallest spell, nor by magic caused one leaf to tremble upon a tree, made one mote of dust to alter its course, or changed a single hair upon anyone's head.
David Thorpe narrating Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke, which is TB14141.
But the one I think I've read the most that I always turn to, I think, is Lewis Carroll, The Adventures of Alice in Wonderland. And I think it's just one of those books. I love everything about it. I love the tone. I love the humour. I love the fact that it's talking about the insanity of the adult world through the eyes of a wise and rational child. The wordplay in it is fabulous. The idiosyncrasies and weirdnesses of the English language. It's just gorgeous. And I've mostly reread it actually on audiobook. There's an amazing audiobook of it read by Fiona Shaw, and she does the best voices, and it's just a joy to listen to. And I've listened to it a zillion times.
Alice was not a bit hurt, and she jumped up onto her feet in a moment. She looked up, but it was all dark overhead. Before her was another long passage, and the white rabbit was still in sight, hurrying down it. There was not a moment to be lost. Away went Alice like the wind, and was just in time to hear it say, as it turned a corner, "My ears and whiskers, how late it's getting!" She was close behind it when she turned the corner, but the rabbit was no longer to be seen. She found herself in a long, low hall, which was lit up by a row of lamps hanging from the roof. There were doors all round the hall, but they were all locked, and when Alice had been all the way down one side and up the other, trying every door, she walked sadly down the middle, wondering how she was ever to get out again.
Fiona Shaw narrating Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll, which is available commercially. An alternative talking book version is available from the RNIB Library. It's narrated by Robin Holmes. And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
So I'm reading at the moment The Descent of Man by Grayson Perry, which is great. It seems actually, coincidentally, a kind of nice companion to my book, because whereas I'm talking about the damaging gender conventions of femininity and how that damages women, he's coming at it from a male perspective of how the gender conventions of masculinity are damaging men. So it's a kind of serious subject in that sense, but it's obviously got Grayson Perry's just joie de vivre, his vivacity and his charm, and it's a joyful read, even though it's a serious subject.
I have struggled to find a name for this identity that would trip off the tongue, or does not clutter the page with unpronounceable acronyms like WMCMAHM. The white blob was a strong contender, but in the end, I opted to call him Default Man. I like the word default, for not only does it mean the result of not making an active choice, but two of its synonyms are failure to pay and evasion, which seems incredibly appropriate considering the group I wish to talk about. Today, in politically correct 21st century Britain, you might think things would have changed, but somehow the great white male has thrived and continues to colonise the high-status, high-earning, high-power roles.
Johnny Phillips narrating The Descent of Man by Grayson Perry, which is available commercially and hopefully on its way to the RNIB Library soon. Holly Kite, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show. Remember, you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the new address, radio@rnib.org.uk. That's all we've got time for today, but we'll be back at the same time next week. In the meantime, don't forget our podcast. Just search your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show, to subscribe, rate or review the show. You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at RedSail, which is RedSzell, and producer Robert is at Talking_Books. Farewell until next week and the next chapter of Read On, the audiobook show.